Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. Here's Jane Williams.
Lots of women and some men have waited tables at some point in their lives. If you have, you'll know how challenging a job it is. You have to stretch the limits of short-term memory. You have to balance plates and cups on your arms. You have to move around quickly and efficiently in a crowded space. Yet we're used to thinking of waitressing as unskilled work. You don't need you to use your brain to do it. Mike Rose challenges the notion of mindless labor in his new book, The Mind at Work. He talked to carpenters, plumbers, and hairdressers, among others, and documents the intellectual demands they face daily in their jobs. Mike Rose is a professor of education at UCLA. He's also the son of a waitress and the nephew of a welder and a foreman. Mike Rose joins me this morning from California. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jane.
In the introduction to the book now, you say that you've been thinking about intelligence and how we measure it for a long time. Why is that? What is it about that topic, this topic that fascinates you?
Well, you know, that topic, of course, is part of the intellectual landscape of the professional world that I've inhabited for so long. As a teacher and then a professor of education, these questions about ability and competence, I mean, it's part of the ongoing series of issues that people deal with. But my particular interest in it in relation to this book comes from the fact that, as you mentioned in the introduction, I come from a background of all blue-collar and service workers. So, you know, I grew up in the midst of that kind of work and watching the display of competence and ability and intelligence all around me. And then when I found myself in my professional life, I was increasingly concerned about some of the easy attributions that we tend to make as a culture about folks who do blue-collar and service work. And so this book is a kind of convergence, I guess, of those two parts of my life, my own background, coming from the working class, intermixing, if you will, with my professional life as somebody who thinks about these questions of intelligence and learning and ability. And so I tried to bring them together in this book.
Now, right at the beginning of the book, in the introduction, you say that you grew up witness to the intelligence of the waitress. What is the nature of the thought that goes into being a good waitress?
Well, you actually did a very nice job of summarizing some of it in the lead-in to the interview. The waitresses I observed and talked to, and that included my mother, by the way, and then all the work I was able to find done by psychologists on the memories of bartenders and waiters and waitresses, all of it leads me to think that the efficient waitress is, first of all, is, as you say, able to really hold a lot of things in short-term memory, you know, who's getting what, who ordered what, what regulars typically like what things done to their food and what they like with it. So there's a lot of memory work in the midst of motion, right? The kind of keeping things in memory as you're moving through your station. But also as you're moving through your station, as you pointed out, there's a lot going on. So the good waitress is able to pull different tasks together. She's able to rank order them, if you will, on the fly and think about, gosh, what can I do while I'm back at this particular part of the station? So that, as one waitress put it, so that you're not running back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, which would just tire you out and be inefficient. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff going on the fly as well, grouping tasks and prioritizing them.
But, one of the reasons that I identify very much with the section about waitressing, because I did waitress part-time for 7 years, and so I can really testify to the intellectual demands that are required to do that job.
Right. Well, you can certainly remember this business of trying to think of what you can do together that will save you making that extra trip. Another quality that I found really interesting is I guess what you could call a vigilance. Cognitive psychologists would call it the attending, and that is the good waitress just is alert to things. As she moves through her station, you know, she's seen who's waving a cup and wants a refill, or who dropped a fork, or who's signaling to get some extra mustard or something. But she's also, and my mother, I thought, had a really nice take on this, she's also just sort of alert to what's going on in her station. So, for example, if somebody ordered a shrimp plate and that customer seems to be sitting there for longer than it should take for that order to be prepared, a little flag goes up in her head, right? Did something go wrong in the kitchen? Did something go awry with the order? So she'll check on that. Now, all of this, and remember, as you pointed out, is going on in the, especially at rush hour, is going on in the midst of a lot of action. So there's all these demands on your mind going on simultaneously. In addition to all that, though, if you think about it, clearly the waitress's income depends on her tips. So she has to have a pleasing presence, and this is where we get into the whole business of service and how appealing was the service. And people tend to talk about that just in terms of personality or maybe emotion or somebody's pleasing. But if you think about it, that takes a lot of thought, too. I mean, being able to read social cues, being able to, you know, kind of balance and negotiate people's emotions. You know, do you have a grumpy regular customer on the same day that the cook's in a bad mood? And how are you going to handle returned orders? And, you know, all of that calls for a kind of social intelligence, if you will.
Now, you spent some time in a high school woodworking class. What kind of intellectual skills come into play when people are learning to build objects in wood?
Right. And here, you know, we have a different set of skills, right, and a different set of intellectual demands. Although, in some tasks, certainly memory comes into play, as we saw with the waitress, and certainly the ability to kind of work smart, right, to group and rank order what you can do when. But as I watch these young people master the rudiments, anyway, of the carpenter's trade, certainly the first thing you notice is the whole business of tool use and learning how to use tools, not only use them well, but know when and how to use them. You know, what's the right tool for a particular job? And as people get better at using tools, then how can you improvise? You know, if you watch the good mechanic or the good carpenter, when they don't have a tool, a particular tool that they need, they're often able to use an existing tool to make something happen. So certainly all the business that surrounds the learning as well as the effective use of tools is, I think, demanding. And as well, of course, you, as a carpenter, begin to learn the steps of assembly. If you're a cabinet maker, let's say, and at first, when you're learning these things, there's a lot of kind of conscious thought involved in during the various steps in assembly. I mean, even the simplest of tasks could involve 100 or more steps if you broke that task down. And for the young person learning, that's what has to happen. As the carpenter gets more mature, he or she then is able to perhaps group some of those steps together or function more efficiently. It certainly goes faster, but there, then, another thing kicks in, another intellectual thing kicks in, and that's this whole business of planning and thinking ahead and visualizing, right? I mean, all of the business that comes with planning, with problem solving, with anticipating, and as I say, visualizing. I have a nice example. It's very brief, if I could give it to you. I was watching a carpenter put in some French doors in a house, and this was in a fairly constrained space, and these were sliding French doors. So he's standing back, and he's looking at the space, and all the pieces are laying out on the floor. And so I asked him to just kind of talk out loud, you know, what was going on? I could see that he was ruminating on this whole business. And it turned out that a number of things were going on. And as he put it, he was trying to see it in his mind. So he's picturing all the pieces of these doors coming together in assembly, and he's wondering, he's trying to imagine what might go wrong as part of the doors, the panels, are sliding over the stationary parts. You know, is there something perhaps in the fixtures or in the way these doors are going to move that might create a problem? Also, he's thinking about the threshold on the outside of the doors and how it's got to be at a particular angle if the rain's going to run off it. While he's doing all this, he's noticing that the casing for the inside of the door is wider than the other woodwork in this room, and that he's going to have to do something to refashion that, otherwise it's going to be aesthetically unpleasant. So all of this stuff going on simultaneously in his mind I found to be really interesting. And the final thing to say, and I guess everybody would recognize this, is that there's mathematics involved in all this. I mean, and not just the simple mathematics of measurement, but a kind of material geometry, if you will, where congruence and symmetry and proportion and the properties of angles and all that come into play. So these were some of the things, Jane, that I saw going on when I was watching these young carpenters learn their trade.
Now, there's a lot of talk in among the tradespeople, both the experienced ones and the ones who are learning, about the look of a thing. You hear electricians talking about an installation that was pretty, and they actually use the word pretty, or changing something just because it was ugly. And these would be thing wires that are hidden in the wall and that nobody is going to see except another electrician. Were you surprised to hear aesthetic judgments about this kind of work?
Well, that's so interesting that you bring that up, because in fact it was one of the pleasant surprises of this study was just how ever-present aesthetic concerns were. And it seemed to me that there were at least a couple reasons for that. One is what you alluded to, that, you know, as one carpenter in Tracy Kidder's book, House, puts it, he says, what looks well, works well. And so some of the time, of course, a tradesperson's concern about look has to do with function or structure, that the thing that looks good is also built well. And in a way, maybe you could anticipate that. But what was a bit surprising to me was how often folks would just put a little extra effort into something or even redo it, not because it wasn't functional or sound, but because it just didn't look pretty, as one person put it. Or as another guy put it, he said, it's just too ugly, and he redid something. So there's also, I think, a sense of just wanting something to look pleasing. And you know, Jane, what struck me too as I was doing this work and thinking about it is how we often sell short that aspect of work. I mean, when we think about aesthetics and appearance, too often I think we think of, you know, just the arts and maybe even highbrow culture. But in fact, it seems to me that we're really aesthetic beasts, you know, that this concern about pleasing appearance and some kind of harmony or symmetry or clean lines, it just runs throughout what we do, and I certainly saw it in all kinds of places.
Now, your Uncle Joe worked at General Motors, eventually working his way up to foreman, and you quote him as saying that there's no such thing as unskilled work. That's an unusual comment when you think of a car factory assembly line. What did he mean by that?
Yeah, that was an interesting statement, wasn't it? And, you know, I mean, it's typical in the way jobs are categorized to talk about unskilled, semi-skilled, and skilled. And, you know, these words obviously mean something. I mean, digging a ditch is different from being a cabinet maker. So clearly the cabinet maker's job involves a whole set, of skills and a knowledge base that is different from, took longer to develop than the ability to shovel dirt out of a ditch, right? But my uncle's point, I think, was really a good one, and that is that no matter how rudimentary the job may seem, for example, the job he started out doing, which was called wet sanding, basically a water hose and a piece of sandpaper, and all day what you did was smooth out the chassis, the bodies of these cars that were about to be painted, and that was considered the least skilled job at the factory. And yet what he pointed out was that we're good at this, developed a whole set of routines that were really efficient and effective, It saved labor for them as well as produced a good job. They had so many swipes that they would take to paper over one part of the car versus another part of the car. There was a certain kind of finesse, if you will, that they developed. And that was the point he was making, that whether you're talking about, you know, shoveling dirt in a ditch or wet sanding or carrying things, that even that calls for the development of a certain ability if you're going to be able to do the work without killing yourself and if you're able to do it effectively. So I thought it was a really nice point that he made.
Now, you also spent some time in a very different world, that of surgeons. Why did you decide to do some research there?
Right. Well, you know, the purpose of the mind at work is to, as you said earlier, to demonstrate the fact that all this work that surrounds us takes more thought than we tend to grant it. But there's a bigger purpose to the book too, and that is to try and get us to just think in a harder way about what we mean by intelligence or how we categorize whole classes of people as being smarter or less smart than others based on the kind of work they do, and then to raise even further questions about, you know, whether or not that's good for the culture. So it occurred to me that one way maybe to help shine some light on this business of the, you know, this troubling business for me of the distinctions we make between quote-unquote manual work and quote-unquote mental work, that one of the ways to maybe get into that from a different angle was to look at people who do use their hands but are highly respected and get paid quite well and whose work is considered to be very high status. So I spent a summer with surgeons, and it was very interesting because here is work that is that everybody is a very highly demanding, high IQ kind of work, demands medical school and all that knowledge that they gain from the books of anatomy and physiology and biology and human biology and that. But what was so interesting is that as you actually watch the work being done, it was such a nice mixture of both the quote-unquote mental and the quote-unquote manual that it really led you to just realize that you can't make that separation, that the manual is the mental, and the mental is the manual. And so it's the same thing I saw with carpenters, it's the same thing I saw with hairstylists, that these neat distinctions that we make, Jane, are just not that neat when you actually get in close to the work. And that's why I wanted to look at surgeons, because I thought it would give shine another kind of light on this problem.
Well, there's a part in the book where you're watching a surgeon, you're listening to him talk about when he moves from laparoscopic technique, where they're going and using a camera and then using instruments remotely, to a technique where he's actually got his hands in there, and how he talks about you need to get a feel for the tissue and how the tissue is moving, and you say, that made me think of the plumber who has to see with his fingers. And I thought, well, that's a deeply radical kind of a remark.
Well, I'm glad you think it is, because I was hoping it to be that. You know, that, look, I'm not trying to say something silly here. I mean, if I need to have some kind of medical work done, I'm going to go to a surgeon and not to a plumber. So clearly there are very real distinctions between these types of work. And, you know, they're based on all the things we know, the kind of training and the amount of risk involved and the stakes involved and all that. I know that. But what I wanted to suggest is that some of the basic kinds of operations, some of the basic kinds of skills and talents, some of the basic kind of mental work may not be that different across a whole lot of different kinds of work. So the ability to develop a refined tactile sense that is combined with a set of ideas, in other words, what something feels like means something, and it has a body of knowledge that it taps into. That happens with plumbers, and it happens with surgeons. And I think that we just would do well to recognize that some of these abilities are spread across occupations more than we tend to think.
What are, do you think, the long-term consequences for a society that really does look down on manual workers and think that they're not smart people?
Yeah, well, I think it matters. I think it matters actually on several planes, you know. One is I just think we should have an accurate representation of what different kinds of work entail. I think that's important. But the way we think about work and workers is certainly going to affect the kinds of educational interventions we develop, the curriculums we develop. It certainly affects the kind of job training we develop. You know, if you think that people aren't that capable or that the work they do doesn't require that much, then that's going to determine the way you organize work, the way you train people, the way you educate them. So it certainly has important consequences for us immediately. But also, I think it's just not good for a democracy. It's not good for civic life for a whole bunch of us to assume that a whole other bunch of us, by the work they do, are not that capable. I mean, I think it just contributes to the kinds of cultural divides that we've been hearing so much about in the United States in the last month or so.
Now, you are in the faculty of education. What are the lessons for educators in all this?
Well, I think that there's, as I said a moment ago, there's some immediate ones, right? I mean, it certainly would affect the way we think about things like vocational and technical education. And some of those discussions have been going on in the United States, I know, and for a while. But it certainly, I mean, it would certainly affect the way we think about school and schooling. And I think on a theoretical level, too, for folks like me, I think it forces us to just think a little bit harder about intelligence and how easily we tend to assume things about intelligence based on the work people do or the kinds of lives they lead. I just think this is part of what we ought to be talking about, and some folks in education certainly are. So it has both immediate consequences, that is, for schooling and things like vocational technical education, but I think it has also broader consequences for just the way we talk about this business of using our minds.
Well, I really enjoyed the book, Mike, and I want to thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
Well, Jane, I enjoyed the conversation a lot, and I really appreciate your interest. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I've been speaking with Mike Rose. He's a professor of education at UCLA. His book is titled The Mind at Work, and it's published this year by Viking.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada.